From Music City, USA, it's David Hooper and Music Business Radio.
From the TuneIn Broadcasting Studios in Nashville, Tennessee, this is Music Business Radio, your backstage pass to the biz. I'm your host, David Hooper, and with me today, one of country music's most successful and critically acclaimed producers. He's also an engineer, musician, and songwriter. Hit songwriter, 20 number one singles. He's got 6 Grammys, worked with the Judds, Jody Messina, Shelby Lynn, Kenny Rogers, Kathy Mattea, just to name a few. Brett Mayer, welcome to Music Business Radio.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here. I'm excited to be here.
We're trying before the show to count up how many records your work has been on. 60, 70 million?
I think that would be in the neighborhood.
Well, let's talk about how you got started, because it wasn't always that way.
No. I started out, you know, as a musician, as a kid, and played trumpet first, then guitar, and had bands, you know, all the way through high school. And
what kind of music were you playing?
Well, just rock and roll. Oddly enough, my parents hated country music. So I was raised basically on the music of their generation, which was big band, you know, Duke Ellington, just all the great stuff. And of course, all of a sudden, rock and roll became our generation's music. And so I fashioned anything that I was going to play, you know, after Elvis and Carl Perkins and all those great records made back then.
Speaking of Elvis, what a great segue. You engineered one of Elvis's records, last couple of them, actually.
Yeah, it was the song Way Down. I think it was his last number one record as a single. And oddly enough, I didn't get a chance to meet him. It was kind of an odd thing that his producer, Felton Jarvis, had his whole band here in the studio at Creative Workshop, and I was the engineer then. And Elvis just couldn't make up his mind when he wanted to come in. We stayed there for 3 full days, from 2 in the afternoon to 4 in the morning, and no Elvis. And the last day, Elvis gets on a plane, heads back to Memphis. His producer, Felton, of course, is freaking out because he spent an enormous amount of money, not one note recorded. But he does have 3 or 4 rolls of 2-inch tape in the trunk of his car. Thank you very much. And we listened to it the next few days, and I actually spliced together line by line a vocal on Way Down. And then we, once we got the vocal put together, had to add all the instruments back into it. A challenge.
Even more of a challenge back then. Pro Tools didn't exist.
Oh, no.
And we're talking literally razor and tape.
That's exactly right. Like when the 2-inch tape would go by, it would just look like butterfly stitching on your stomach or something. It was just one edit literally every 25, 30 inches. And then it really got hard when I tried to mix it, because we went from our 16-track down to a quarter-inch, 2-track stereo. And there again, no automation. And so I couldn't really just set it and say, this sounds good, make a few adjustments, because every time it quit singing, the original band cut in his living room would just like rush into the mic, and then it would wash out everything that we had just added to it. So I actually had to mix the thing, like literally 2 lines at a time, splice that together, finally got through it all. And like I said, it was this huge hit, but I had to work so hard on it, and it was not much love coming back to me. And I didn't enjoy it. I couldn't enjoy it until years and years and years and years later that I heard it in this little gift shop in Colorado along with a bunch of other Elvis songs. I said, well, that thing sounds pretty good. So anyway.
Well, you know, you've worked with a lot of legends of rock and roll. Ike Turner. Ike and Tina Turner, actually,
right.
But Ike Turner is credited for the first rock and roll record, and you weren't there for that one, but you were there for another big one, Proud Mary.
That's right. It was a real great, great experience working with Ike and Tina, and Tina as a vocalist still ranks up to me as like arguably one of the finest singers I've ever worked with. I mean, just when I say explodes on a microphone, just gives it up. You're in a studio environment, headphones on like we have, and in her mind, she's giving it up like she's in front of 10,000 people every time. And Ike was just great, soulful guitar player, and we got along so well. I did 3 albums with him. It was really a good experience. Wound up actually writing for Tina later and co-producing, you know, a few things, just Ike and myself and Tina.
What do you think it was about Ike and Tina Turner or Elvis that has given those records some longevity? I mean, obviously it was great people splicing a lot of 2-inch tape reels, but beyond that, what was it about them that made them so special?
Oh, if I knew that explicitly, so I can just stumble along here. with Elvis, it was just he was the right guy at the right time, and it was at the beginning of just an entire cultural change. So he was the focal point for a teenage generation that at that time was really never marketed to. When I was a kid, we were just marketed our parents' music. When Elvis came along, that was an absolute focal point. This is something for the kids, and I hope your parents hate it. And now, having said that, there were a lot of people breaking into rock and roll. Obviously, Elvis was a lot more than that. Elvis was just Elvis, you know. And the songs they created back then that he picked to record, you know, from Heartbreak Hotel to Don't Be Cruel and et cetera, et cetera. A lot of those are my favorite. Actually, the Sun recordings are really my favorite. And early RCA, like Hound Dog, Don't Be Cruel, those things they did up in New York were my absolutely favorites. And then with Ike and Tina, they had a relationship that started off wonderful, ended up not so wonderful, you know, because if you've seen the movie, there was a lot of ugly stuff that went on there, which oddly enough, I never knew anything about. And I was with them a lot. So it's the old line that Kenny O'Dell wrote that great song about, what goes on behind closed doors. There was never any abuse in the studio or harsh words or anything. It was just a groove. You know, when they would ask me to play something back that we just cut, I mean, it was like going to church in a control room. I mean, the band, Tina, Ike, I felt like a wee bit out of place, you know. But I was trying to catch up to them. But anyway, what makes those records like Proud Mary turn to be sort of an iconic rock and roll song, those things are just magic and hard to put a thumb on about how that happens.
David Hooper, Music Business Radio. My guest today, Brent Mayer. We're talking about how he got started in the music business, his work with legends like Ike and Tina Turner, and also Elvis Presley. So you were a kid. Mm-hmm. We were talking about that before we got into the stories, because you got a lot of stories. We're going to probably kind of go down some rabbit trails today. Is that all right with you?
God help you.
Yeah. I got to get some of these stories out of you. But you were a kid and playing music yourself. Mm-hmm. How did you switch over into the other side of the glass, as we said?
Well, when I got out of high school, I joined the Air Force because college wasn't an option. Back then, you know, the draft was in place, and so I didn't feature myself getting into the Army and doing all that stuff, so I joined the Air Force. And as soon as I got to our permanent base, you know, I put a band together so we could make extra money on the weekends, playing at the Officers Club, NCO Club, and wound up getting stationed in Nashville. And so at the time, the Charlie McCoy had his band, the Escorts, and there was a band called the Sliders and the Gators, the Exotics, and a band called the Almond Joy, you know who that was, right? The Almond Brothers, thank you very much. But those guys were playing around here. In my heart of hearts, I knew as a guitar player, and I knew that our band was a good cover band, but nothing I could really sort of say I can make a living at this. And I was a guy that always sort of like had a concept of what the stage volume should be and made up the set list. And always when I listened to records, I always sort of wound up listening inside of them. I would visualize the studio. And one evening, and it was a revelation, an absolute revelation, I was laying on my couch and I had one stereo speaker on, basically on each side of my ear. And I was listening to a Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions album, which I dearly love their music. I was just lost in it, and I opened my eyes, and in the bottom right-hand corner, it said recording engineer and this guy's name. And I had about 2 years to go in the Air Force, but I said right then and there, I said, man, that's what I'm going to do. When I get out of this thing, I'm going to become a recording engineer. So I started studying while I was still in the service, various courses on electronics and acoustics and whatever I could to sort of at least look like I was trying to learn something. From there, got very, very fortunate and landed my first job when I got out of the Air Force.
What was your official first music business job?
Well, it was an assistant recording engineer, which means I get there first, make the coffee, fill up the Coke machine. All the musicians, there was no cartage back then, so I would help carry up amplifiers, clean tape machines, move mics around, basically just absorb the studio environment. And they flush you out pretty quick, like Bill Porter, who was an absolutely legendary engineer that did most of Elvis's records here, Everly Brothers, all of Roy Orbison records, from Only the Lonely On to Pretty Woman, all those things. He was basically became almost a father to me, because my parents had passed away at a very young age. So Bill basically was more than just a boss. He was just like a father to me. So eventually, when he felt I was ready, he gave me my first demo session. I sort of flogged my way through that, you know, and didn't upset anybody too much. But my first real deal to do, which I almost panicked and had a, well, I did panic, but I made it happen. But anyway, we were cutting a Joe Tex session. And Joe Tex was really good friends with Otis Redding. And so Otis was at the session too. Now, this is when Otis is so hot and Joe's really hot. And so I'm the backup engineer. I'm making sure that the multi-track is there, which was back then a four-track. And, you know, Bill, my mentor, the dude, was doing all the mixing. And they blow the ending on this particular song. Well, back then you would say, well, let's just do a work part. And a work part is when the band says, okay, we're going to start, you know, eight bars before the screw up. Take it from there, and then, you know, we'll splice it together. And that's how it was done, tape splicing. So they blow this ending, very close to the ending. I'm fixing to get out of my chair, so Bill, my boss, who can do no wrong, will put this thing together, and I'll watch and learn. And Bill looks at me and says, I'm getting some coffee. Put this together, Brent. Panic. So the guitar player comes in, who's the band leader, is over one shoulder. Otis Redding is on my other shoulder, and Joe is behind them somewhere. And I've got this tape going, quack, 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 making a mark on it to where I feel I'm going to take the first splice. Then I run down to the work part. Quack, 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 quack. That's moving tape, by the way, back and forth across the heads. And then I make a little pencil mark on that, and I have to cut the tape physically with a razor blade on those two marks, and then put them together and say every prayer known to mankind that I picked the right spot. Right before I cut the tape, the guitar player dude says to me, you cutting it there, man?
A lot of pressure.
So what am I going to say? I turned back, I said, yeah, man. And I put that thing together, and I swore off everything. I run the tape back, and it went through like butter. And Otis says, that's nice. And I figured, I passed the test. But I told Bill, if you ever do that to me again, I will quit. And he says, you did great, Brett. Next song.
Well, those skills certainly came in handy for later in your career working with Elvis.
Mm-hmm. And oh, God.
We're going to play some of that right now so people can hear your splicing and mixing handiwork.
Okay.
So here's Elvis Presley, Way Down, engineered by my guest today, Brett Mayer. More from Brett when we come back on Music Business Radio.
When I can feel, 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 way down where the music plays, way down like a tidal wave, way down where the fire plays, way down.
I'm Ronna Rubin, owner of Rubin Media. I've been dabbling in publicity, living on the cutting edge, trying not to get hurt, and you can find me on Music Business Radio.
Why can't a bank offer you the kind of technology that actually helps your company's productivity? I'm not talking about a computer that takes the place of a banker, but technology that, though I don't know, maybe lets you deposit checks right from your own office. At Avenue Bank, they have it, and they'll tell you all about it. It's safe and secure, and it saves time. And isn't that what technology is supposed to do? Avenue Bank. The difference is real. Member FDIC.
From Nashville, Tennessee, it's Music Business Radio. David Hooper here. My guest today, Brent Mayer. Proud Mary by Ike and Tina Turner, legendary song, and you're involved with that.
Yeah, I engineered that record and mixed it at United Recording in Las Vegas, actually. It was a great, great facility, and it was a sister studio to United Western in L.A., and then there was United Recording in Chicago. And so a lot of people would shuffle tapes just back and forth. How I wound up working with Ike and Tina, I was the chief engineer there. They were in town, you know, working, I think, the Hilton, opening for Bill Cosby, of all people. That was that time when the whole Las Vegas music scene was changing. from, you know, Jerry Vale and Tommy Dorsey and all of the era of music from the 40s and 50s. Now, people that were headlining all the major rooms were like Dinah Ross, the Supremes, Motown acts. Like Sly Stone was actually, you know, working at the Pussycat Go-Go there, and which actually I engineered on some of that record too, his first album. But a lot of those artists were just there working. They knew that it was a really good studio, so they booked it for a couple of weeks, and that was my first record that I did with them. And then we got along so well, I wound up doing three records for them, and then wound up going to Ike Studio there in L.A. and doing some stuff there too.
It sounds like working with Bill Porter early on was a big part of your success. He kind of, you know, brought you up to speed.
And right.
Sometimes when you didn't want to be brought up to speed. Talk about the biggest lesson that you learned from him.
I think the biggest lesson I learned from Bill is just always being part of the team. Always making the musicians feel that this is their environment and we're there to make the musicians comfortable at every single level. And he exuded, which, you know, you can only do with a lot of experience, so much confidence that everybody knew whatever they were going to play was going to get captured. I can only say that I hope to aspire to that when I'm working with artists, that I make them feel as comfortable in their creative environment as I know that Bill did.
Let's talk about working with artists. What is it about an artist that gets your attention?
Well, if it's a new artist that somebody has approached me about to consider working with, whether it's somebody that I've never worked with before that actually has a career going, or whether it's a brand new artist that nobody knows anything about, first of all, I have to sort of have a feeling that I can bring something to the party, that what they want to do, I truly get. And if I truly get it and say, I love it, I think I have a concept and can help you achieve what your overall concept is, then I'm pretty much in. I have to love it, one thing. I can't get involved with a record just because I'm a professional producer and I know how to make a good sounding record. I mean, that's a lot of people can do that. If I'm going to get involved, it has to be something to where I feel really connected to musically somewhere. If I feel that, then I'm ready to jump on board.
I've listed a lot of bands that you've been involved with. The list seems to go on and on. It's very impressive, very impressive. But one of the biggest has been the Judds.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get connected with the Judds?
Unfortunately, my daughter got into a car accident. She was still a senior in high school, and Winona actually was going to school at the same school, Franklin, here in Tennessee. And Naomi was a registered nurse and was just assigned to that floor that particular week and was assigned to take care of Diana. Well, by then, you know, my career had taken off as a record producer, and Naomi already had a vision on what she wanted to do and what she felt she could do with her daughter. Why? And once my daughter was completely recovered, she approached me and said, I hope this doesn't sound inappropriate, but I'd like to give you a cassette of just my daughter and I singing in our kitchen. And they just record on just a little portable recorder there. And if you could listen to it and just tell us honestly what you think, whether there's something that we should pursue or maybe not, you know. So I did. I loved it. I loved it the first time I heard it. And called him back and said, I think we need to talk about this. And so one thing led to another.
How often does that happen? I imagine you get approached a lot with tapes and CDs now, and maybe MP3s too.
Mm-hmm. It happens quite a bit. To be honest with you, that's the only time that I've heard something that stopped me in my tracks. And it absolutely did. I was driving from our little farm in Franklin into town, and I just, well, I better listen to this. So I stuck it in there and listened to it, and I just, as soon as I got to the studio, I got on the phone because I could hear just something fresh and exciting, not only Winona's voice, which is obviously is pretty hard to miss, but just their musicality was something that really intrigued me.
You're listening to Music Business Radio. This is David Hooper, your host. With me today, Brett Mayer, talking about discovering the Judds. When you hear something like the Judds, obviously it's a mother-daughter duo. Were you thinking like marketing as well, or is it strictly musical talent that you're listening to?
Strictly musical talent. When I would first tell people that I was working with this mother-daughter duo, it was actually like, what? It sounded absolutely very square, for lack of a better word. It sounded really like, what do they do, you know? And so anyway, no, I didn't have any thoughts about, oh, gee, this can play out because the mom looks like she's 25, even though she's 35, and my daughter's a great, 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 great singer, and how that could all, no, I didn't think about that at all. Strictly about what we could do musically, and that did not come quickly. That came from about 9 months, at least, of me going to their house like maybe once a week, and we'd sit down and play guitar, and they would run music by me, everything from the Boswell Sisters, which was something they hipped me to that I had no idea who they were. They were like pre-Andrew Sisters. But then they would play me some obscure bluegrass things, Larry Sparks, all kinds of odd music. And then right in the middle of it, some Bonnie Raitt song that I knew. So it was just going back and forth and sometimes leaving with a headache. Like, I have no earthly idea where these girls are coming from. But finally, we landed on a couple of songs that gave us bookends. And that was Had a Dream, that Dennis Lindy wrote. And then Mama, He's Crazy, that Kenny O'Dell wrote. And then the middle of that was a song called John Deere Tractor. And all three different, but all three would fit. And so to me, it was like, okay, we got our hip, kind of a funky, bluesy country thing with Had a Dream. And then we had more of a really great sort of country song with Mama, He's Crazy. And I said, everything between this and that will work.
Mm-hmm.
That was our point A.
You brought a song called Why Not Me.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, more than a song. We've got the original demo. Talk about that song and talk about the demo and the recording process of the final product.
Well, the song was written by the legendary Harlan Howard and Sonny Throckmorton and myself. And how that happened, we were starting our first full-size record, and we had everything cut, and I knew we were minus one song. I'd written, you know, some things with Harlan Howard. What a blessing that was. And I called up Harlan, like, on a Friday, and I said, Harlan, this is Brent. He said, Brent, what's up? And I said, man, we need to get together and write. And he says, well, sure. And I said, but how about tomorrow? He says, no, that's Saturday. And I said, well, I know. He says, I'm fishing. I said, Harlan, this is like for the Judds. And he says, they can wait. I said, no, Harlan, I'm panicking here. I need something. He says, well, how about Sunday? I said, I'm all right with Sunday. And he said, well, Sonny Throckmorton's in town. Do you know Sonny? And I said, I've never met Sonny. He says, great guy. We need to get him back in a circle. And I said, I'm fine with that. And he said, all right. And I'm begrudgingly, Harlan allowed us into his house, you know, to write this tune. So we wrote the tune. And when we got home that afternoon, I remember we had this little funky demo, not the one you're going to play, but one with actually Sonny singing in a wrong key, you know, which was challenging. But my wife and kids said, well, it was a long day. And I said, man, it was a long day. And said, you get anything? I says, I honestly don't know. And they said, well, let me hear it. So I played him our little demo we did at Harlan's house. And my wife said, that's the best song you've ever written or ever been part of. And I went, oh, good to know. I played it for the Judds, and they just absolutely loved it. We, did a little pre-production demo, which pre-production is something that I'm probably to a fault way into. Before I go in and record anything with an artist, with a full band, we always go in with one or two people, make sure the key's right, make sure the song holds up, make sure the song fits the singer, if the singer didn't write it, let's say. You know, it's twice the amount of work, but it saves you so much time in the studio. So we did just like a little demo with me playing a sort of a drum part on the back of a guitar, Y playing acoustic, Don playing acoustic, and then the girl singing, you know.
And you're speaking of Don Potter.
Yeah, Don Potter. He was the lead guitar player on every single Judd record. Other than Let Me Tell You About Love, which was Carl Perkins. And Don didn't mind. He didn't mind giving it up for Carl, you know.
And Harlan Howard, for those that don't know, is probably one of the most prolific country songwriters ever.
Not only country, everything. I Fall to Pieces, to I'm Busted, Heartaches by the Number. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, you know.
It's longer than your list.
Way, 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 way.
And that's a pretty long list.
Way longer.
Well, let's check out Why Not Me. This is the original demo on Music Business Radio.
You've been looking for love all around the world. Baby, don't you know
on this country girl still free. Why not me? Will you finally come down to your old hometown? Your Kentucky girl's been away patiently. Why not me? Why not me on a rainy day? Why not me to love your cares away? Why not me? Why not me when your nights get cold? Why not me when you're growing old? Why not me? You've been searching from here to Singapore. Ain't it time that you notice the girl next door, baby? Why not me? You had to see if the world was round. It's time that you learned how good settling down could be. Why not me? Why not me on a rainy day? Why not me to love your cares away? Why not me? Why not me when the nights get cold? Why not me when you're growing old? Why not me? You've been looking for love all around the world. Baby, don't you know this country girl's still. Why not me? Will you finally come down to your old hometown? Your Kentucky girl's been waiting patiently. Why not me? Why not me? Baby, why not me? La 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 la.
Why Not Me, the original demo from, I guess, Brent Mayer on Music Business Radio. I really love the urgency of that. It's like a mom and a daughter hanging out playing music.
Well, you know, there's something to be said about urgency. I think sometimes with the technology we have now, some of that's missing. Making records up until we were sort of in the digital world, you had to make decisions. You had to capture things at the moment. You could not make a mistake on hitting the play and record button. You couldn't make mistakes like that. So there was a bit of being on the edge of your seat basically all the time, whether you're an artist, whether you're an engineer, a record producer. You couldn't go back and keep remixing things 50 times because it all came back automated, you know, like we have nowadays. So I think a lot of the imperfection, a lot of the rawness, a lot of the energy that's captured with all of that going on is something that a lot of artists miss today. Not everybody, but a lot of artists miss that.
Well, Brent, one of the things that you mentioned was just a great song has to be at the core of it. You're a hit songwriter, 20 number one hits. When we come back, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into that, talk about song selection and what makes a great song and a great songwriter. Brent Mayer is my guest today. David Hooper, Music Business Radio. More from Brent when we come back.
Hi, this is Joe DiMessina, and you're listening to Music Business Radio, your backstage pass to the biz. Run away! No. You don't want to know! The stuff you think you want to know.
From the TuneIn Broadcasting Studios in Nashville, Tennessee, this is Music Business Radio. I'm your host, David Hooper. With me today, Brent Mayer. Listening to some Duke Ellington. You're involved with this, Pitter Patter Panther.
I'll tell you what, I am so honored and thrilled to the bone that I actually had a chance to record the Duke. This was a project, it was just a duo project with the Duke and Ray Brown. And of course, this is the music that my parents raised me on. After seeing, you know, some of the great old movies from the 40s and 50s, when you see the Duke Ellington Orchestra, when they booked United Recording and I was going to engineer it, I just couldn't believe that I would have that opportunity. A fun little story about that. I mean, it wasn't that much to record, just a piano and upright bass. But hanging with Duke and Ray and Norman Grants, who was the producer, who was a legendary jazz producer, one afternoon we got done recording. Ray had left early. I think he and Norman went together, and Ray was on the phone talking to somebody else. I mean, not Ray, but Duke was. So Duke walks out to the lobby of the studio, and he's going to call a cab. I said, Mr. Ellington, I said, I would be glad to just take you back to the hotel. You have to call a cab. And he says, well, young man, that would be wonderful. And I said, well, great. And so I had a brand new little yellow Mazda, you know, the engine goes buzz or whatever they did. And so I just opened the door, and the Duke got into my little yellow Mazda, and I drove him to his hotel and talked about my mom and dad raising me up in Kansas, you know. And he was just the most, hard to put words to it, gentle, sophisticated man that I have ever met in my life, by far.
Do you find that the more established artists, the guys that have really paid their dues, the guys that are in their woodshedding, practicing, are they easier to work with just maybe because of that? They remember where they came from as opposed to the American Idol generation that gets instant success?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The artists that I've had the opportunity to work with that are, by no other words, call them stars, from Kenny Rogers, people like the Duke, and a lot of the other people I've worked with, like Gladys Knight, even though she was at the top of her game back then, you know, it wasn't like she was a legend then. They've got so much confidence in their own talent, they don't feel they have to prove anything. Kind of a bit like when you're in the military, the really nice guys are your full bird colonels on up and light birds. Majors maybe, captains on down,
Trying to prove something.
Yeah, they're still trying not to get passed over that third time and get to boot. Sorry, gents, if you're out there.
So I want to talk about songs. You are as much a songwriter as anything. 20 number one singles.
Well, I've got that many awards, ASCAP awards. I don't know if they were all number one. I think I've done that many number one records and around that many awards as a songwriter.
Earlier, we were talking about the Judds. How important are songs when it comes to making a good record? Could you work with like mediocre talent and a great song, or is it better to have great talent and a mediocre song?
Well, I've only worked with people, whether their talent at the end of the day, everybody else thought they were great, was always remained to be seen. But at the time, I've always felt like when I'm in a studio, I'm doing the next big thing. Whether that happens or not, I mean, more times than not, it doesn't happen. But I feel like it's going to happen. And so to me, everything has to match up. I wouldn't have an artist that I feel has really got something special and then try to spend time with a mediocre song and vice versa. So it pretty much has to line up, at least in your own mind. Not saying people are going to agree with you, but at least in your own mind, I always try to get matched up a really, really good song with a really, really good artist to perform it.
You talked earlier about technology with production. Sometimes you have almost too many options. Now, in Nashville, we have some great songwriters. I heard once that 1,500 songs are being written every week, and that's by the established writers. Mm-hmm. So do you sometimes maybe cut more songs that end up on the album? What exactly do you look for when putting together the completed full album, so it's like a full album rather than just, you know, a bunch of songs thrown together?
For my taste and the artists that I wind up working with, we always enter into a project with a complete picture in mind. If I've ever completed a record and said, gee, every song's like a single, then I know it's not a very good record, because it means like you've got 10 two-minute commercials, one right after another. And for some of the successful records that I produced over the years, I cannot tell you how many times people have come up to me and said a particular song was their favorite, and it was not necessarily a single. Now, granted, songs like Grandpa, Mommy's Crazy, just talk about the Judge real quick, or Why Not Me and songs like that, obviously a lot of people have taken those to heart. But a lot of people have taken songs like Dream Chaser, a lot of tunes, John Deere Tractor, songs like that, that meant every bit as much to them. So I've always tried to make sure that we have an ebb and flow in an album as if you are watching a performance live.
Yeah, you think about great speakers. They are energetic one moment, then they'll bring the energy down.
Sure.
They're energetic again, because it would be like, I guess your ear would get numb if it was the same thing throughout the whole record.
Exactly right.
You've got another great one here, another demo. It's by another legend of rock and roll, Carl Perkins.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Let Me Tell You About Love. Talk about the story behind this.
I was asked to actually produce a record on Carl years ago, which I was stunned because when Blue Suede Shoes was a hit, I was probably maybe 9 years old, and it was one of my favorite records ever to this day. In fact, I never really liked Elvis's version of it, man. I was so into Carl's. So when I actually got to meet Carl, you know, 40 years later, I just couldn't believe I was with this man. He said to me one day, he says, you know, Brad, he says, I like the way you write. He said, we ought to write something someday. And I said, well, God, Carl, I'd love to do that. I was writing a lot then with Paul Kinnerly, who is a wonderful, wonderful songwriter and a great guy. And he's British. And I knew that Carl just, oh, the British folks, they, you know, the hallowed ground that they put people like Carl and Roy and some of these people on is like at a very high level. So I said to Carl, I said, man, I'd like to invite Paul Kinnerly on this writing session. Are you cool with that? And he says, well, sure I am. So Carl drives to Nashville and we write this song. It was more fun. And I have to tell you this, before we did anything, I just sat and looked Carl right in the eye. I said, you know what? I've got to get over this. Would you just play for me 30 seconds of Blue Suede Shoes? I know that sounds god-awful, but would you just do that? He says, yeah. Oh, it's one for the money, two for the show. Did the entire song, the solo, and performed it on his acoustic like he had just wrote it yesterday. That much passion. That's what Carl Perkins is all about. Every note of music that he ever wrote or absorbed was so deep in his soul, it was nothing but God-honest spirit coming out of that man. So anyway, having said that, and he was so kind to do that for me, we sat down and we started banging on guitars, wrote this song, and God, we all just loved it. And so we demoed it in this little garage studio that Paul had, Carl on guitar, which is just smoking. I'm playing acoustic on it and then singing harmony, you know, with Carl to a little drum machine, and I just adore it.
Let's check it out. Let Me Tell You About Love, Carl Perkins, demoed by my guest today, Brent Mayer.
Cats and chicks, and this life don't amount to much without a hug and a kiss and a tender touch. And let me tell you about love, about the moon and stars above. It's what we've all been dreaming of. Let me tell you about love. Just let me tell you about love.
Let Me Tell You About Love, Carl Perkins. That was a demo cut by my guest today, Brent Mayer. He also wrote the song, worked with acts like The Judds, Shelby Lynn, Kenny Rogers, Kathy Mattea, and others. More from Brent when we come back on Music Business Radio.
Why can't a bank's website be more about its customers? After all, a website should be there to help you, not the other way around. Like Avenue Bank's website, it's easy to navigate and use. With Avenue Bank's online banking, you can view all your financial accounts, including those you might have at another financial institution, with just a single login. Visit thedifferenceisreal.com and see for yourself. Avenue Bank, member FDIC.
I'd hate to see mine torn apart. I know that I should run away. But these feet of mine ain't got no sense. They got me stuck up on this fence. Feel like I'm about to fall. Oh, what am I to do? Temptation, temptation. Should I give in to this temptation? Temptation, temptation. Should I give in to this sweet temptation?
Oh, yeah. Nashville, Tennessee, it's Music Business Radio. I'm David Hooper, your host. With me today, Brent Mayer, a hit songwriter, producer, musician, and engineer. You listen to Shelby Lynn, the song Temptation, and this is an example of one of the projects you do where a label comes to you. And talk about working on this song.
Well, it was pretty interesting because I got a call from Jim Mazza, who's a legendary record company executive, president of Capitol Records during its heyday, started EMI America Records, which of course was just huge with Jay Giles and guys, just so many big, big hit records back in the 70s and 80s. Jim called me up and we were just talking. He says, man, what kind of a record would you like to make? Like, if you could make the record of your dreams, what would it be? And I said, well, Jim, oddly enough, I've been thinking about that. I said, so what I would like to do, I would like to pretend that Count Basie came into town, or the Duke, either one, with a full band and said, I want to jam with the hottest country musicians alive, and I want me a chick singer that can stand up right next to him. I said, now, I know that'll never happen, not in Nashville, but that's what I would like to do. He says, so you're saying what? You're saying like sort of a country vibe to the thing, but with like a 16-piece plus big band section? I said, absolutely. I said, except instead of like trumpet scat solos, I'd have like a smoking fiddle player. And he said, So he says, let me get back to you on that. And we talk some more. We hang up. He calls me back 30 minutes later and says, you want to make that record? I said, yeah. And he says, well, I got the girl for you. He said, I've already talked to her, Shelby Lynn. And I went, Shelby? And he says, yeah, man, I've talked to her. She's way into it. Her parents grew up, you know, playing that kind of music. I mean to tell you, it was crazy. And I said, you're serious, Jim. He said, I am dead serious. And so I said, well, I'm in. So that's how that whole thing came about. Now, of course, there was no songs being written around here for that because that was a music yet to be discovered. And so Shelby and I and Jamie O'Hara, one of my most favorite writers in town, wrote probably 2/3 of the record. And then I wrote a couple of really, really wonderful songs with Mike Reed on the project. But it was absolutely one of the most fun projects I've ever been involved with.
And that's something you do a lot. You customize the song for the particular project.
Right, right.
So that's one of the ways that a producer would get work is when label president, they say, hey, we've got an established artist. We're looking to maybe change up what they're doing or do what they're doing even better.
Right.
And they'll come to you. But you also are kind of a gun for hire. You're a mercenary out there looking for new talent, just like you did with the Judds.
I probably get the most enjoyment out of that. Somebody turning me on to somebody yet to be discovered. It's all fresh ground. It's all the big dream is way out in front of you, and there's no baggage. There's no history about, oh, I don't know if I can do that. When you start from scratch, everybody feels you can do anything. And I like to go into any project that I'm working with that in mind.
Well, let's talk about Shell. That's one of your new projects.
Right, right.
And this is fantastic. And this is the artwork on this, the design, art direction is absolutely amazing. Then I look down and it's actually one of the members of the band.
It's crazy. A friend of mine, a great radio guy, a program director out in Denver, John St. John actually, calls me and he says, Brent, do you have time to go out and see this band in Fort Collins that I've been telling you about? Because he emailed me a couple of times about this group. And I said, I'm on vacation. Of course I have time. So we went from Estes Park, where I was at, down to Fort Collins, about an hour drive. And I had no idea what to expect because I walk into the living room. They've got like a rehearsal studio set up in the living room. I mean, the whole 9 yards, drums, stuff. But the lead singer is playing mandolin. And then the bass player also plays violin and fiddle. And the drummer, who is the youngest in the batch, she's just turned 16. And then a great keyboardist, who's the oldest at 21. Just a variety of instruments. I have no idea what I'm going to hear. And they start playing music, which I swear to God, I have never, it's some musical concepts I've never heard before. Vocal arrangements I've never heard before. And in making records, you know, getting close to like 42 years, I've heard a lot of licks and I've heard a lot of vocal arrangements. And then it goes even beyond that. They've taken classes in film producing. So they make their own videos. They do all their own artwork. It's pretty amazing.
Now, do you think the reason you've never heard it before is because they're young, maybe they don't know the rules, so they're breaking all the rules, they don't have the limitations like you were talking
totally.
About?
Totally. Absolutely. If it sounds good, if it comes, if it's musical. Now, having said that, they are all classically trained players. In fact, the drummer's first instrument, oddly enough, is a harp. And she went from harp to hand drums, which she is stunning on, into a trap kit. So they've got a tremendous amount of education for as young as they are. So they also compose classical. So they have all of this stuff to pull on, like the latest contemporary music of the bands that they just love. They've got some of this melodic structure and stuff that comes from classical pieces that they had to study and learn, and then they write and they compose themselves. So you blend all that together, and it's an incredible sort of art form that this band's creating.
So I've got the new EP in my hand. It's called Try to Scream. This is available. Their website is I Love Shell, and it's SHEL.com. There's also a great video of this song on YouTube, and the song is called The Latest and Greatest Blueberry Rubber Band. So if you want to get an idea of what the art looks like that they're doing, what the video looks like that they're doing, because they do it all themselves, check it out, iloveshell1l.com, and here is The Latest and Greatest Blueberry Rubber Band by Shell.
1, 2, 3, 4. Ooh, ooh, ooh. Magic flies by like a crimson butterfly. Flickers of a memory in the twinkle of an eye. Jelly beans make you hop high above the silver moon. Find your way back down to earth just by the red balloon. Ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ooh. Ooh, ah, ooh, ah, ooh, ooh, ah, ooh.
The Latest and Greatest Blueberry Rubber Band is the name of the song. The band Shell, and the producer, Brent Mayer, is my guest today on Music Business Radio. We've been mentioning it throughout the show. You've got a huge list. Bobby Darin, Carl Perkins, Winona, Nickel Creek, Kathy Mattea. So you've had a lot of success in the business. Does that automatically kind of get you the carte blanche when you walk in with a new act?
It can get you an appointment. That's about it. Because at the end of the day, people are going to have to get bowled over by something, which is more difficult every year. I mean, it's competition's tough. There's a lot of great music out there. And you really have to give people something that they feel that they don't have, number one, and number two, nobody else has. If you can, walk through that door at the right time, things can fall in place. I've been involved in working with artists that I felt very passionate about that it hasn't happened to. And those are the puzzling ones when you know that you've got somebody that can really sing and they're good writers, but it just doesn't seem to fall in place.
Do you have any specific advice when it comes to dealing with rejection?
If I got discouraged every time somebody said, you must be kidding, or no, I don't get this, nice try, but Brent, love what you do, come back and play something else next year, that never dissuades me. And somebody asked me years ago, if it takes you so long to work on a record, because sometimes you can easily work as long as a year on one record, how can you possibly stay up on something? How can you not be bored to death of a particular song if you've overdubbed on it, if you've cut the tracks, blah, 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 for hundreds of hours? And oddly enough, it's real easy for me, because what I do in my mind, I rewind to the very first second that I heard that song. Whether somebody played it for me or whether the artist wrote it and they sat down and played it for me and I got goosebumps. I couldn't wait to get into the studio. I knew it was something special. You could put a gun to my head going to the grave and I would still say I was right. No's don't bother me at all. They make me mad, but it doesn't bother me.
Do you think that right now is a better time to get in the business than when you got in?
You know what? I don't think so. We're all born and enter into our careers at our own time. And so whatever in front of us is in front of us. When I broke into the business, there was no formal training. To get into the door, it was a very small window. When I started engineering, most of the engineers in town I thought were sort of old guys because they were like 38 to 40. And they broke in through television and radio stations like this, you know, learning how to engineer and work a microphone and things like this. But I walked in with none of that. I just had a desire and walked in the door at the right time. Now, in today's world, you got MTSU here in Murfreesboro, Belmont, Appalachian State, not too, well, you know, North Carolina, I guess, and all around the country. And they're putting out graduates on a yearly basis. And unfortunately, there's not enough room for them. We have recording schools scattered all over the nation. They're coughing up young would-be engineers and producers. Studios are dwindling. So there's fewer jobs on that hand. On the other hand, there are opportunities for very entrepreneurial people that can make quality records in your bedroom. So there are opportunities out there still. It's just not some of the same opportunities that I had when I started. You have to think differently. And I've actually talked to some of the students at Belmont about this. This is the time to where you have to think of the overall business. A little bit what I do, which is writing. We have a publishing company. I engineer. I produce. Play a little bit. Now's the time when you really sort of need to be leaning that way. And even if you're not a player yourself, you need to think along those lines as far as the business model. You know, if you want to be an engineer, be thinking about, I might want to lean into some production too. Like the Shell record you played. The credits on that one will be co-produced by myself and Shell. Trust me, that is a truly co-produced record. They start those records in their house. Eva's got a little Pro Tools set up in her bedroom. When I get the tapes, the lead vocals are all done. All the vocals are done, harmonies and everything. And then we just shuffle things back and forth. So it's truly a co-production. But that's the technology that is available out there to be used, you know.
One more question for you. What has been the absolute highlight of your music business career?
Oh, God. Oh, have mercy. I'll tell you what that is. It has got nothing to do with awards. I was walking through O'Charlie's restaurant with a friend of mine, David Conrad, who was a publisher in town, and he was very good friends with Chet Atkins. Chet and I knew each other, but weren't really, you know, close or friends, because I just hadn't been around that much. And Chet Atkins grabs me by the arm as I'm walking past the table, and he pulls me back to him, and he says, "Hey, Brent." I said, "Yes, sir, Chet." And he says, "I just want to tell you, you're making some great records." That, to me, I think is probably the highlight of my life, musical life.
Yeah, it's great to have not only fans love you, but your peers.
I just about fainted. I think that particular moment, as far as just having somebody make me feel good about what I was attempting to do, you know.
Well, Brent, appreciate you being here. This has been fantastic, and you've got a lot more stories. We're going to have you back. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next week, where I'll interview another industry guest.
Thanks for listening to Music Business Radio, a production of Tuned In Broadcasting Incorporated, Nashville, Tennessee. Recorded in the WRLT Lightning 100 studios. Music Business Radio is produced by Gary Crane, David Hooper, and Dan Buckley. Hosted by David Hooper. Engineered by Dan Buckley. Demo Derby coordination by Gary Crane and Jesse Smith. Special technical assistance by Tom Hansen. With Pro Tools post-production by Justin Hamill and Dan Buckley. And Lester brought the bail money, but didn't need it. For information on syndication, guest booking, demo derby music, or downloading previous episodes, visit musicbusinessradio.com.
Music Business Radio.
You've been listening to Music Business Radio, brought to you by Avenue Bank, dedicated to serving the music business industry. Find out more at thedifferenceisreal.com.